The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Again, it's Tuesday. It is the 4th of December, and we have less than 3 weeks until the 21st. The drums are beating. The Mayans are angry. Well, some of them are angry about the hype and the commercialization and the con job that has been pulled off on the December 21st, 2012 hustle for years now. I'll bet $1 billion all told has been made on it. Probably, maybe more. Who knows? I don't know. It's impossible to track. But I would suggest humbly that we'll get past the 21st, Christmas will come, New Year's will come, and we'll be off into 2013 before you know it. Up first, first up tonight, busy night tonight, George Filer is with us, of course, the first Tuesday of each month. George, the Eastern Director of the Mutual UFO Network, and the publisher of the best UFO newsletter on the internet. You can get it free delivered to your electronic mailbox just by emailing George and asking him for a copy or two or as many as he wants to send. They come out every week and they are remarkable in their breadth and scope and wonderful pictures and special features. It's quite an extraordinary thing. Filer's Files, of course, is the name. George, are you there?
I'm here.
Welcome back.
For the introduction.
Of course, of course. How many on the list now? Are getting the Filer's Files each week?
We're sending emails to 13,000 people.
Wow. Good job.
Might be 12,986 or something, but, you know, in that general area.
13 to me. I remember when it was just a couple thousand.
Right. A lot of people decide they like it and enjoy reading it. I get a lot of nice comments about your show and, you know, being on it and so on.
Well, we always enjoy our visits, and a lot of people do as well. George has been at this a long time, since he chased UFOs over Europe in service to this country as a member of the United States Air Force. He is a major retired and has been in the UFO game now 50 years at least, George, right? Since you saw your first... As a very young man.
Yeah. I even saw him as a child.
That's what I'm trying to get at. You've been at this a long time. Now, we have always George's latest editions up at rents.com. We're going to put them up there shortly for you. But in the meantime, you can click on George's name and go there and kind of amble through the year. We are at edition number, what are we now, 49 coming out this week?
Right.
So we have 47, 48, 49 comes out this week, and we're almost to the end of the year, guy. Gee, it's just amazing.
Goes fast, doesn't it?
Oh, it's ridiculous. Doesn't slow down at all. Okay, now, we have a special guest tonight, I believe,
right.
Who's going to join us in a couple of minutes as well. You want to talk about issue number 48 just for a bit, and then we'll bring our special guest on?
Right. Well, Frank Chile is with me, and sitting next to me, actually. He was
very
kind
good.
Enough to come over to our house. And well, naturally, we're talking about numerous sightings. We have almost 2,000 sightings a month from all over the country and basically all over the world. And people aren't necessarily aware of that, but we try to talk about some of the better sightings. And an old friend of ours, Commander Graham Bethune, we've been discussing him lately and
yes.
all the things that he's told us. And,
yes.
And it seems like as we discuss him, we remember more and more things that he said, and most of them are coming true or, you know, are being revealed to the public through other sources these days.
Right. If you look at issue number 48, there's a feature about Commander Bethune at the top, showing him pictured in a cockpit. He drove, he drove through the skies in what we used to call a DC-6 or a DC-7. He's a very fine pilot and was involved in a lot of interesting things. What was that? What was the military version of that plane called?
Yeah, the R-5D.
R-5D. So it was a
four-engine aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And he was flying the Atlantic in 1951, and he had one of the first verified sightings of a very large craft. Actually, he thought he saw, you know, like a city on the water in the Atlantic Ocean, and he's some 3,400 miles outside of Argentia, Newfoundland. So obviously a city couldn't be there. And as they watched it, it came up and flew in formation next to them. Matter of fact, it got so close that he dove the plane down to get out of its way. And there's some 30 pilots and naval officers and even psychiatrists on board the plane that could all see this huge craft, in effect, flying formation with them. And the commander reported this to Argentia, and when they landed, they were met by intelligence personnel and debriefed.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, he found this information among the boot book files. So he had numerous, officers who had seen the object, and it was reported, and then, he had a complete report that he had given to the Air Force and was in their files, and even had some of these other pilots that were on board at the time who saw them.
Well,
interesting.
It was a very extraordinary group of people, to be sure. Go ahead.
And so he was kind of well-known within the Navy and even in the government as, you know, having had seen UFOs up close firsthand. So,
and lived to tell about it.
Right, and lived to tell about it.
Yeah.
And he, during the sighting, he went back, you know, to tell other people that, you know, look out the right side window, you know, there's the UFO and so on. And he talked to a psychiatrist and said, you know, look out the window. And the psychiatrist said, well, I can't because those type things don't exist.
Yeah, that's a great line. Great little story.
Certain people just can't accept the fact that, you know, something from outer space is there. But he was, well, everybody was seeing it and believing.
Yeah. Well, we don't pass judgment on those folks. To, you know, to each his own and her own. If you can handle it, fine. If you can't, that's your choice.
So. But because he had seen the UFO, reported it, and it was pretty well known in the Navy, he was assigned to the Air Transport Squadron, where all the high-powered admirals and generals and so on were flown, kind of like equivalent to the military's Air Force One. And whenever there was a crash of a UFO, he would fly the admirals and generals. For example, he flew General Marshall twice to landing sites.
General George Marshall.
Right. He was one of the, you know, great generals, uh-huh, as well as the other admirals. And, of course, since he had seen a UFO, they would tell him certain things about them, and he got to see crash saucers and the whole work. So he was quite important on the information.
When did Commander Bethune pass on? It was several years ago.
Yes.
I really wish he was still around. Did he ever sit down and record any of this, either on video or audio?
Well, he yes. I don't know.
It's on YouTube.
Some of it's on YouTube,
yeah.
Okay, yeah, we're going to talk to, that's Frank Chile. We're going to talk to Frank in just a couple minutes after the break. So there are some Commander Bethune pieces on YouTube. By all means, look them up. That's Bethune, Graham Bethune. And this week's current edition of Founders Files, issue number 48, has a very nice tribute to Commander Bethune at the top. Lots of information there as well. You knew him well, George.
Well, pretty well. We were together and often spoke, you know, at different conferences.
Uh-huh.
And, we spoke at the University of Toronto and flew back, and he had his car, and we're driving in a snowstorm back. And he actually went out of his way to drop me off at my house. And there's something about being in a snowstorm in the middle of the night and skidding around and him telling stories about UFOs that...
you never forget.
Right.
That's quite an image, for sure. Okay, very good. I think we have a break coming up here, and then right after the break, we'll say hello to Frank again. And the last time we talked to Frank was last month, when you were at a wonderful dinner, and
right,
kind of had the pleasure of joining George Filer as he was a guest at a wonderful dinner party and had some extraordinary information. We'll talk to George and Frank next. Stay right there. Okay, and here we go. Glad you're along this evening. We have a fascinating program, starting it off with George Filer and our special guest, Frank Chile, who joins us for the second month in a row. Let's, George, go ahead and put Frank on, if you would, and we'll get into that conversation.
He's right here.
I'm here, Jeff. Good evening. Pleasure being with you again.
Very good. Thank you, Frank. We have two phones, so you both can be on. Excellent.
Jeff,
okay.
I just wanted to bring to your attention and the audience's attention that Graham's title was VIP pilot commander with top secret clearance for the flag division.
Wow. Say that again.
VIP pilot commander with top secret clearance for the flag division.
Well, it doesn't get any more prestigious and important than that when you're an aviator.
That's the way I viewed it.
There are a few people who have knowledge of Graham. He is not a household name.
No,
in the field. And that's one reason I'm very glad to see George bringing this out. Did he have a request, George, that that he not be talked too much about before he died? Or was he just kind of a quiet, reserved gentleman?
I think the latter. At least he never said that. We spoke together on a number of occasions. And he seemed to, at least in his later years, want to get the information out, I think. And he was, you know, certainly he gave a lot of excellent information. Matter of fact, he gave me so much information, I didn't believe it all until I started checking it out from other sources. And pretty much everything he said has been supported.
Right. Okay, Frank, tell us more about Commander Graham Bethune and some of the things that you know about him. And what was your relationship?
I met in 1982, and I met him at the New Jersey has a UFO meeting in Hamilton Township at the public library once a month, and that's where I met Commander Bethune.
Uh-huh.
And as George said, he was very quiet, he was very humble, but he had a wealth of experience and background that he would be willing to share with anybody who was open to listen.
He could, but had he wanted to be, he could have been a superstar in the field of ufology.
Very well could have been.
That's not the kind of man he was, but, I mean, he had that much experience, that much inside information, that much data to share. So, anyway, go ahead, please.
Anyway, Jeff, he was one of the very first individuals to volunteer when Dr. Stephen Greer was putting together the Disclosure Project.
Sure.
Graham wanted to go on the record that he knew of not only people that he had worked with in service, but people in other service that he had met over the years that had experience with the craft that wanted to come forward, but they needed amnesty to protect their own well-being, so to speak. And Graham did several video presentations with Stephen Greer, and there's probably maybe 8 or 10 different YouTube interviews with him talking about his own experiences and some of the things he was involved with. So I would, as you had said previously, invite your audience to check it out on YouTube.
Good. So there's a heritage there that we can look at and listen to and derive certainly a significant proportion of the data he has.
And also his discussions with the astronauts that he had known personally, the Mercury 7 astronauts. And the one he was closest to was Gordon Cooper. And Gordon had supplied a lot of information to him about his own experiences.
Yeah.
And he knew that Graham had been written up in Project Blue Book for his experience back in 1951.
Right.
And he said all the astronauts had experiences that they wanted to come forward to talk about, but it was only Gordon Cooper who was the most vocal in public, and, you know, look how they tried to excoriate him.
You know, Gordon Cooper was, again, a very quiet, a humble man, not in anything for ego or any kind of preening, self-adulation. He was on the program a couple of times here, and I was amazed at what a gentleman and how matter-of-fact he was about everything he discussed.
Yes.
Same thing, I guess, with Commander Bethune. All right, we just have a few seconds here, so when we come back from the break, Frank, I'd like you, if you would, pick out a few stories and anecdotes and things that you might want to share with us that
absolutely,
I think our listeners would enjoy. And for those of you who can listen to the archives, last month's visit with George, the first Tuesday of November, you can go to that dinner party with us all, and Frank made a major contribution that night as well. So we'll be right back in just a couple minutes. All right, let's get right back to work. Right at the top of headlines under the Japan stories, the Fukushima batch up there, are George Filer's most current two editions, number 47 and number 48. Talking to Frank Chile about Commander, late Commander Graham Bethune, an experienced and outstanding aviator who had access to top secret information and saw things that are obviously extraordinary. All right, Frank, tell us more.
Graham was close personal friends with Admiral Forney, and Admiral Forney had given him photographs of disks that Graham would share from time to time. Matter of fact, in the most current issue of Filer's Files, the photograph of a disk landing on an aircraft carrier, Graham had given that to me, and that was dated from 1955. And apparently Admiral Forney had had his own sighting, and he is shown on film. I brought some information to George's attention that a film was run by Clark McClellan, a former NASA science officer.
Clark's a friend of mine in this program. He was just on last week.
Well, you may want to discuss this with him about a sighting of a 400-foot disc over Gander, Newfoundland, that was sighted for refueling. A plane was sighted for refueling in 1956, and have film about it. And apparently in that film, Admiral Forney mentions his own sighting.
Huh.
So I don't know how available that film is or how classified it is.
Yeah,
but
yeah. Now tell me about this picture, which all of you can see if you go to George Filer's current edition, number 48, in the headlines at rents.com. Scroll down a bit in the top featured section. You'll see a picture. It's a black and white picture of Navy jets on an aircraft carrier, three, four of them, and what appears to be a large, unusual-looking craft landing there. Now, you have that picture?
I have that picture. George had the original. Commander Bethune had the original.
Yes.
Or a copy of the original, and mm-hmm. he made a copy for me, and I gave a copy to George so he could put it into the newsletter.
Is this a high-gloss 8x10 kind of picture?
Yes.
And this picture, you find it looks like it's stamped on the right-hand side, U.S. Navy. When this event occurred in 1954, there was no Photoshop.
No.
So how does it look to you? Rock solid?
When I saw the original he showed me, it looked rock solid.
Mm-hmm.
And he
okay.
also showed me a photograph of a disc where they went for a crash retrieval in Utah of a 100-foot uh-huh. disc that was he had piloted General Marshall out to.
Yes.
He showed me a copy of that disc as well, and that was remarkable. Just a remarkable photograph.
Wow. Onward. Let's keep going.
There's a couple experiences that I had where people shared some information with me, basically along the lines of what we're discussing. And I've really never revealed it publicly, and if you would be so kind, I'd be happy to share some of the information with you.
Oh, by all means. I'm all ears. Go ahead.
A friend that I've known for a long time arranged a dinner meeting with me and this individual who had some experiences. And the person was in the Navy, but he was in a naval facility in Florida that you would never think was a naval facility. And he was at a point at this facility where they were doing monitoring. He didn't tell me what they did, but he said over the 2 years that he was at this facility, they had craft come down during daylight hours five times. And he said the craft were between 30 to 50 feet in diameter. He said they would hover between 30 to 40 feet above the facility, and it would basically shut everything down. And he said that whenever this would occur, they would sometimes be in sight, and they would be photographed both still footage as well as motion picture footage for the 10 or 15 minutes that they would be in view, and then they would take off, and they would immediately get a visit by ONI, Office of Naval Intelligence, and they'd
yes.
be debriefed,
yes.
and they'd have to sign statements that they couldn't disclose what they saw. But he said this occurred five times, and after every leaving, they had to repair the equipment because the equipment was just all shorted out.
Trashed. What year was this approximately?
This was in the late 80s. I'm going to tell you two stories in the late 80s pertaining to some usual events.
All right. Well, this facility, unidentified as it is, clearly was known to the people flying these craft, and they didn't like it for some reason. They wanted to interfere. They wanted to make life miserable. They wanted everybody to have a bad hair day down there. And so they fried a lot of circuits, it sounds like, what you're telling me.
Well, he said that they were debriefed not only by ONI, but other intelligence agencies, but ONI had the horsepower. They were the ones basically did the heaviest debriefing and, you know, put the fear of God basically in them. But he said that after the third or fourth time this occurred, ONI was really upset that they had to come in and debrief these guys again to make sign statements. And the person who was telling me the story said, hey, listen, it's not our fault. We're just here doing our duty. And these craft are coming down and they're creating this nightmare scenario for them. But he said no one was ever hurt. And he said they were completely silent. He said there was no heat signature off of them, no distortion underneath the discs. And he said they were in full view of everybody at that facility.
Well, they were obviously creating some kind of a nuisance. If they wanted to destroy the place, they would have.
That was not their intention. But he never told me the work that was done there. All he would say is that they had very sophisticated equipment, and they were there doing monitoring work. And they were interfered with five times over the 2 years.
Monitoring, as in tracking, potentially.
Potential.
Uh-huh. All right. Very good. Fascinating.
And about 2 years ago, I was doing some traveling down in Nashville, and I happened to be staying at a hotel, and as I was leaving the hotel, I got a chance to run into somebody, and as a course of doing business, I was talking about his vehicle. He was operating a fleet of heavy trucks, and one thing led to another, and he said that when he got out of the service, he decided to go into trucking business. And I said, what branch of service were you in? He said, he looked at me, and he said, well, I was at a Navy base where you wouldn't expect a Navy base to be. And I mentioned to him Utah, and he said no, and he said Arizona. And he said he was stationed at a facility in Arizona that was highly restricted.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about things, and he said that they were working on some very unusual devices. And I said, did it have anything to do with particle beams or with anti-gravity or magnetic pulsing? And he looked at me, and he said, well, he said, we had a private plane come in over our airspace, and they were warned not to be in that area, that it was a restricted area.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we brought it down. And he said, we used the device. He said, you know, you don't have to use anything that explodes. He said, you could use a device that is not incendiary or doesn't explode and have a tremendous effect. And I said, are you talking about something that's anti-magnetic or anti-gravitational? He said, they fired something at this jet that took the wing off. And he said it was about the size of a golf ball. He said that, I said, what kind of acceleration did it have? And he said it was about 90 Gs. And I said, what kind of impact? He said the impact was about 85,000 PSI. And he said,
yeah, I get the picture.
You don't need anything bigger than a golf ball to be able to bring something down. And I said, what kind of range does it have? And he said they had the capability of taking up satellites with something like this.
Sounds almost like a railgun of some kind. But,
I don't know, but this was in the 80s. He was at this facility for 2 years in the 80s in Arizona.
So they killed the people in the plane?
No, the people that landed in the plane, the plane was not too far off the ground.
Oh.
The plane was brought down. It took the wing off, and of course the passenger or the pilot was taken under arrest because he was violating restricted airspace.
I see.
But this fella shared with me this information regarding this
Have
device that they had.
He said
that was only one of several different type devices that they had there, but I found
well, this lines right up with the old axiom that whatever we think the military has, we're thinking decades behind what they have. And I would submit that this is a perfect case in point.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I wanted to share with you and your audience, and you know, I've never disclosed these publicly before.
Well, thank you. That's fascinating, to put it mildly. There's so much out there, and George, every week in his Filer's Files, brings very interesting information. And again, the most current two issues are right at the top of headlines at rents.com right now. You can take a look. If you want to get a free subscription each week, George will mail it right to your mailbox electronically. Just write to George at Major, M-A-J-O-R, star, Major star, at Verizon.net. And say, hi, George, please send me my Filer's Files. Okay. All right. Frank, onward. This is fascinating.
Never dull.
No. What else do we have?
Jeff, as we were discussing last time, Graham was the first one to bring to my attention that the Navy was the one that was basically in control of the situation with the visitors, with the discs. And he said that the Air Force was basically being used as the fall guy to make the public think that they were in control of it.
Question. You suggest the Navy was in control of the visitors and the discs.
Yes.
Was the Navy, I mean, are we talking about control here, or were they secondary to a technology that was obviously far in excess of what we normally think of in terms of human potential? Who was in control of whom?
Well, I think the Navy was in charge of doing the study work and dealing with the technology, and they were basically giving the Air Force the black eye for having to take all the public heat over what was occurring.
Right. Well, it makes perfect sense. There's plausible deniability, all kinds of things there.
And Graham was the first one that ever brought that to our attention. He said, Frank, he said, don't let anything fool you. He said, it's the Navy that's behind it all.
Well, George, this doesn't surprise you after all your years in this field. And we know, certainly, Gary McKinnon's story. We know about Project Clementine, the Clementine spacecraft, which was a U.S. Navy craft that mapped the photographed the entire moon. And we have also reason to believe that there is a parallel space program that Gary McKinnon talked about briefly that has taken us at least all around the solar system.
Well, Graham never talked about the concept of Solar Warden or the Navy Space Command or the Naval Space Command. He just always referred to it as 10th Fleet. And he said that came under the purview of 10th Fleet.
The 10th Fleet, okay. Yeah. That's the off-planet fleet, folks. And if you don't know about Gary McKinnon, look it up and read about it. Fascinating what he claims to have found during his online dial-up meanderings through top-secret Pentagon data. Just extraordinary stuff. All right,
yeah, they had a big problem with the Chinese in the U.S. Computers and so on. They were apparently stealing stuff all the time. And
well, Gary said he recognized hackers in there as well. Yes,
right. That the Chinese were in there in force.
Right, and probably are in most everything. We know that they have been into the national computer control system for our entire electronic grid. The electric grid could be taken down at any time, apparently. So there's that. Go ahead, Frank, if you have more.
Jeff, I had another story that I wanted to share with you.
Mm-hmm.
We receive a lot of trade publications, and I got a phone call from a trade publication that wanted us to consider doing some advertising with them. And the person that contacted me, I said, where's your office out of? And he says, McMinnville, Oregon. And I said, well, that's really interesting. I said, they had some incredible photographs of discs taken there in the 50s that are world-renowned. He said, oh, you know about that? I said, yes, I do. And he said to me, he said, you know, there's still a lot of activity that's occurring up there. And this was probably maybe about 10 years ago that I had this conversation with this individual. And he said to me, he said, not only is it occurring in the McMinnville area, but he said there's a lot of activity in Northern California that's not being reported, where there would be 8, 10, or 12, 15 discs flying in single file, both daytime and nighttime, that people were seeing and wasn't being picked up.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of several weeks, he would call me and we would talk about business, and he would also be looking to see how much interest I had regarding, UFOs. So he asked me probably about 3 or 4 weeks after we first started dialoguing. He said, have you ever heard of Bob Lazar? And I said, yes. And he said, you know, he was really given a rough deal. And I said, yes, I'm very, very aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what is your interest in it? And he said, well, one of his family members worked with Bob Lazar at S4.
Well, that's another story for you newcomers out there, or folks who want to do more research. Just type in the name Bob Lazar, L-A-Z-A-R, and start reading. It's quite a fascinating story.
Well, he told me that his family member who worked with Bob Lazar was working basically on the same project where they were looking at alien craft and they were working on back engineering it.
Mm-hmm.
And his family member said to him that what Bob Lazar was sharing with the public was indeed true. And his family member correlated it. And I thought it was fascinating that he would share that kind of information with me.
Oh, indeed. Yeah.
Out of the blue, just out of the blue, Jeff.
Well, things happen. Yes, I think there is a lot of UFO activity all over the Northwest, frankly, up and down the coast that is just not talked about. The Cascades, the Sierras, endless opportunities for bases, underground structures, facilities, you name it. It's all there.
Jeff, are you familiar with an individual by the name of Albert Coe? He's the contactee that I got a chance to meet who had an incredible experience. And I call him the granddaddy of UFO contactees. His experience dates back to 1920.
No, I don't know the name. And is he still with us?
No, he passed away.
All right, well,
incredible story. It's not for maybe tonight, but maybe for another time.
Well, let's schedule that. I very much would like to do that. These stories that go way back. Oh, yeah. Well, count on it. Let's get you and George on here. We'll do it maybe in a week or two, and if you'd like.
Whatever works in your schedule.
Yeah, okay, great. Very good. George, anything to add at this point?
Well, I think there's information coming in from, frankly, all sources from around the world confirming a lot of this data. And the English are coming. Of course, they're releasing a lot of data, and it ties in that a person who, you know, doesn't believe this kind of information should look online at various, you know, releases by the government of the United Kingdom, you know, in England and so on, and other countries, France as well. In other words, the information is coming out little by little, and I wouldn't be surprised if we don't have a major announcement in the future that confirms some of this. There's apparently some kind of data that's going to come out about Mars very soon.
Well, that's another interesting issue because, as you know, folks, there was a big announcement about, 10 days ago now, George, something like that, that Curiosity had made a discovery for the history books, an enormously important discovery, and nothing came of it. And then yesterday, a story ran that I posted that supposedly Curiosity has discovered what appears to be carbon remnants. Now, carbon doesn't necessarily mean life, but it's one of the ingredients for life as we know it. So it almost seems that somebody jumped the gun, and whatever Curiosity found, not that we didn't already know it because we have a dual space program, but it was decided to back down from that. I don't know how you feel, but that's the way it looks in the media to me, that they've pulled way back from that.
I've talked to Dr. Gilbert Levin several times, who felt that in 1976, both Viking landers found
correct
life on Mars.
Yeah, he was convinced of it. No doubt.
And he was, you know, a NASA scientist and put together the process for discovering life, and he found microorganisms in the soil on Mars, and I think that's factual information, and it now the only possibility is that we went there first and messed up the climate and created a bunch of microorganisms running around Mars that actually came from Earth. But you know, there's that story too. But I don't know how true it is.
A lot of them out there. A lot of stories out there. Right. We have about 4 minutes, Frank. Is there anything else you want to? We really appreciate you being here tonight and remarkable data.
It's a pleasure, Jeff. I've had a chance to travel around the country and meet with some individuals and have some experiences. I used to visit with Gabriel Green. I don't know if that name sounds familiar to you at all.
No, I don't know that name.
He was out at Giant Rock Airport, and he was a photographer in the Los Angeles area. And when...
with Adamski and that crew?
With that crew and with... Mm-hmm. George Van Tassel, who built the Integratron.
Yeah,
go out there and visit that.
I knew Van Tassel's son. I guess it was his son briefly. Anyway.
Well, there are stories that I could share with you about that and also with Gabriel Green, but he had footage of all the Giant Rock conventions that had ever been held there.
Huh.
And he had unreleased photographs that Paul Villa had taken outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico in 63 of these 300-foot ships that were absolutely astounding.
And you saw these?
Yes, I did. His house was like a museum. Gabriel Green's house was like a museum. He lived in Yucca Valley, the high desert area. Uh-huh. And we would go out sometimes two or three times a month for long weekends and visit with him and some of the other contactees that lived in the area and go out to the Integratron. And we met some very unusual people and some really extraordinary people.
That must have been mind-staggering for you.
It really was.
The films you saw were in good condition, clear?
Absolutely. And I heard that when Gabriel Green passed, some dealer came in from Los Angeles and bought everything.
And bought everything he had.
He had a flying saucer club called Amalgamated Flying Saucer Clubs of America, and he published a newsletter. And he would have people come to him who had experiences with the craft. Some of them had been from the Air Force, some had been from the Navy, and he would publish their stories in his little newsletter.
Another interesting name that is not a familiar one to the community, as I know it.
We'll get some information to you about Gabriel Green.
Yeah, very good. We'll plan on that. If you have anything that you can share visually, all you need to do is make JPEGs of it, send it to me. I'll put it up on a page, or you can put it up on George's site, whatever, and we can go look at some pictures, or however you'd like to do it.
Well, I do have some of the photographs of unreleased Paul Villa photographs that maybe we could get on both George's newsletter and on your site.
Well, I'd be happy to do it. I'll link right to George. That's no problem.
Jeff, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Frank, once again, and we'll do this again here in the next couple of weeks. All right, George, are you there?
Yes. I just like to remind people to look up once in a while. They might be surprised what they see. We're getting a couple thousand reports a month, as you know, Peter Davenport and MUFON and other William Pucker, not other websites are getting lots of reports in. Most of them aren't that exciting, but there are things in our skies on a regular basis. And with the cameras, good photos are starting to come in, and we'd like to share them with people out there. I just got a whole stack of pictures that I'll be putting in from Indiana. In other words, the data is occurring right tonight and tomorrow night, and if you want to look, you can. Good chance you'll see something out there.
They are there, whatever they are, and people can see them. A lot of people don't talk about them. We know that. But there are things up there flying around and probably have been here long before we organized as an allegedly competent species on this planet. And they are
continuing. Might even be the reason we're here.
Anything's possible. If they have the ability to do any genetic tweaking, it's time, because we're going to blow the whole thing pretty soon here if we don't get straightened out. It's just not looking good. Everywhere you look now, war, killing, death, violence.
If there ever was a time for them to make their presence known, it would be now, wouldn't you think?
If it's now or never. Yeah. I still like Robert Wise's premise in his 1951 film, The Day the Earth Stood Still, where the E.T. came down and gave the Earth a very short period of time to completely disarm all nuclear weapons, or the planet would be turned into a piece of French toast, or some other kind of toast. And that's the kind of thing I think would have to be done here to get this species straightened back out again, if it's doable at all, and I'm not sure it is. All right, Frank, thank you very much. Great to talk with you.
Thank you once again.
Sure, we'll do it again. George, thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
All right, talk soon. Okay, very good. Night.
Hey, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, George Filer and Frank Chile, and fascinating information. If you want a copy every week of George's Filer's Files, just write to him at majorstar@verizon.net.